Happy Halloween, Churn. Are you celebrating this weekend?
Sadly, Halloween is not a big thing here in Singapore, so no pumpkins, no fancy dress, and frankly, in 35 degrees, I do not want to be trapezing extra layers of clothing down the street. Well, I'm looking forward, despite being in the same location, to being another hour apart from you, which seems to be something exciting. You're gonna get an extra hour of sleep, isn't it?
Indeed, I'm very much looking forward to that. Anyway, it's Saturday, the 30th of October, 2021.
And this is Ballot to Talk About.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Joining me, as always, is my co-host Churn. How are you doing, Churn? Can you believe that we're back around again in the US electoral cycle?
I'm doing well, Sam, but yeah, I can't believe it's been a year since we started. Our first big election event was the 2020 US presidential elections, and really we're kicking off the start towards the midterm elections next year. So it really comes across very fast, and I can't believe of all the content, all the other countries we have gone round in that period of time, haven't we, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to believe that Joe Biden has been president-elect for nearly a year now, and we'll soon be coming round to some more significant US elections, if not these significant ones this week, because we'll be focusing on next Tuesday's off-year elections, where voters in New Jersey and Virginia go to the polls to elect a new governor and state legislature in what will be the first big electoral test for the 46th president, Joe Biden. But first, Chen, I thought we could have a little look at something that's happened north of the US border, because in the final move in ushering a new parliamentary term in Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has made a bit of an announcement this week, hasn't he?
He has, and he literally made the announcement days before he flew off to the G20 meetings in Rome and the COP26 summit in Glasgow. And he unveiled what his new cabinet, which will begin his third term as head of the Liberal minority government. And contrary to expectations, it turned out to be quite a radical reshuffle, expanding the size of the cabinet to 39, including Trudeau himself, and with a significant number of portfolios having new ministers. And we would like to bring out four themes at this stage, and four significant moves. The first of it is Mark Garneau as Minister for Foreign Affairs is out. Of the former astronaut is no longer represented in cabinet, and his replacement is Melanie Joly, which is Trudeau's second female foreign minister and possibly a reward for helping the Liberals win a third term, because she was one of the co-chairs of the Liberal campaign in the all-important province of Quebec. We also saw a big demotion for Harjit Sajjan, who has become the new International Development Minister and Minister in charge of the Pacific Regional Development Agency. And his former portfolio, Defence, goes to Anita Anand, who has previously been in charge of Canada's successful vaccine procurement. And she becomes the first woman to hold a defence portfolio since former Prime Minister Kim Campbell in the 1990s. Stephen Gilbert, a lifelong environmentalist who has worked for Greenpeace International, is the new Environment and Climate Change Minister, which saw Jonathan Wilkinson move over to Natural Resources. And this appointment is bound to excite those who felt that Canada is not enough, or done not enough on the environmental front, but annoy oil-producing provinces. Seem to be a bit of reverse of what happened in 2019. And finally, in the all-important geographic representation, we do note that with the Liberals returning and our back into Alberta, Randy Bosanow has become the new Minister for Tourism and Associate Finance Minister. And we also like to give a special shout out to Newfoundland, who has two cabinet ministers out of six Liberal MPs. So 33% hit rate, I think, is particularly impressive. With newcomer Goody Hutchins joining Seamus O'Regan as Regional Economic Development and Labour ministers, respectively. In fact, despite losing seats in Atlantic Canada, the whole region seems to have done well, because another former minister, Jeanette Papadatos-Taylor, who is from New Brunswick, joining the government once again as official languages minister, which means New Brunswick will have two cabinet ministers there. So Sam, do you agree with my analysis given the whole range of changes and in fact a lot more besides that this was a surprisingly bold reshuffle considering what people were expecting? And why so?
I mean, it certainly seems on the surface to be quite a bold reshuffle because there are fewer than 10 people in this cabinet who have remained in their positions from before the election out of 38, not including Justin Trudeau. So the turnover in new representation in the cabinet is extremely high, especially for a government that didn't meet its own expectations in this election. Because usually when a government falls short of what they were expecting from an election, they take quite a cautious approach to reshuffle because they might be trying to fend off any leadership challenge insurgency or just try and calm the waters because they haven't really gained the mandate they were expecting to gain. But in this case, Justin Trudeau seems to have increased the turnover of ministers quite significantly. And it was also quite a bold reshuffle in terms of representation as well, because it's the queerest cabinet in history, most notably, and it's also was sworn in by Mary May Simon, who obviously earlier this year became the first Indigenous Governor General of Canada, which was quite a notable event as well. I think one thing to note is that because of what happened in the 2021 election and leading up to it, there were a lot of vacancies, particularly for women in cabinet, because Justin Trudeau wanted his cabinet to be an equal gender split, and because of cabinet ministers who lost their seats in the election or stood down in advance of the election, there were a lot of vacancies available in that regard, which he needed to fill somehow, and they needed to be new appointments to the cabinet in order to do that. And the same applies, as you said, to geographic representation, where new regions boosted their representation in the Liberal caucus, or as you said, in the case of Alberta, returned to the Liberal caucus and needed some representation. So I think it sort of goes both ways. On the one hand, it was bold because turnover was really high. On the other hand, turnover was really high because it had to be to meet the representation aims of Justin Trudeau. So I don't know if you agree with that take, Chern.
Well, I've got one interesting statistic on turnover is that Canada has had 5 foreign ministers in 6 years. So we're averaging about 1 foreign minister a year there. And I think on the women point as well, and I think it's really interesting, is that when Justin Trudeau first came into office, one of the criticisms, yes, it was a gender balanced cabinet. And I'm sure you remember that famous phrase when asked about why he picked the gender balanced cabinet was because it's 2015. That stage, one of the criticisms was that the portfolios in which the female ministers occupied tended to be much lower profile. In that case, the finance minister was a male, the foreign minister was male, you know, the immigration minister was male. What I can tell you now is that the women hold the foreign affairs portfolio, the finance portfolio, the deputy prime ministership, and the defense ministry, all now the big portfolios within government. So it's not, yes, the fact that you can also argue progress is made because the quality of the portfolios has also increased, hasn't it, Sam?
It has, and I think that's one of the big takeaways from this election. And in a minute, when we come to talk about potential replacements to Justin Trudeau and whether this cabinet reshuffle says anything about that, I think we'll be bringing up a lot of women, particularly women who've benefited from this reshuffle as well.
I very much think so too. But Sam, representation is one thing. As we mentioned a couple of times, there are a couple of policy priorities that this government needs to urgently put forward. Do any of these moves stick out to you as potentially showing what Justin Trudeau intends to do over the next couple of years?
I think it's difficult to look away from the appointment of Stephen Gubo as Environment Minister because it's quite a significant appointment around the time of COP26, and I think says a lot about Justin Trudeau's own assessment of his government's limited action on climate change relative to party member expectations, because Gibo is a renowned radical climate activist. it's not a usual appointment to environment portfolios within governments generally, let alone in Canada. And I think it says a lot about the kind of image Justin Trudeau is wanting to present going forward. So I think that appointment is key. The other one that is fascinating to me is the two new positions established at cabinet level, one being the Minister for Mental Health and Addictions and one being a housing minister. And I think it says a lot about domestic priorities of Justin Trudeau in this next term and says a lot about the kind of policy areas that Justin Trudeau is wanting to project to the country as well. Even if that's not necessarily a huge policy focus of the entire government, it's very demonstrative about your intentions and exploring these kind of policy areas. So it seems to me that there's quite a domestic focus of this term in terms of the kind of cabinet appointments we've gotten, whether that be the environment or whether it be mental health or housing. So I think I'll be looking ahead to the next few years of Canadian government and their kind of domestic program, because that seems a strong focus of this reshuffle to me.
Yeah, I think I do agree with you there. And I think I can add several other points of note as well, because even on the environment front, you know, Jonathan Wilkinson, who is the former environment minister, we said moved over to natural resources. He was previously CEO of an environment technological company, and now he's in charge of natural resources as well. So I think there's a clear attempt that, yes, if you want to reduce Canada's CO2 emissions, you not only have to have an environmentalist in Stephen Gilbo and head of the environment ministry, you also need to help green the natural resources sector as well. And it seems like Jonathan Wilkinson's task is very much in that regard as well, particularly where the former minister, Seamus O'Regan, came from Newfoundland and Labrador, which is the previous oil-producing province itself. So you're pushing off somebody who was from an oil-producing province to someone who has a clear background in environment technology. I think that's also adds to what your point is as well. On the point on mental health, that is the appointment of Caroline Bennett as Minister for Mental Health and Associate Health Minister. I think the thing is from the COVID pandemic is that the health portfolio is obviously very large. And I do think that she was put in there as an experienced MP. She had been in Parliament since 1997. And a former nurse, in fact, is that they wanted an extra pair of hands to help in the health portfolio, given all the issues and the continued, you know, likelihood that health is going to be a big part in this government. And again, that is leaning towards that domestic policy angle as well.
Let's not forget that in Justin Trudeau's manifesto in this election, one of the key policy proposals was a $4.5 billion investment into mental health. So establishing this position and putting a steady hand like Caroline Bennett in charge is a clear demonstration that this manifesto commitment is something that the government wants to try and deliver.
Exactly. And same as Amit Hussein in housing as well. We're expecting some big moves in the housing portfolio over the next couple of months. But my point about Caroline Bennett is as well, is that the other key thing we're seeing is that we're seeing ministers who have been in the same portfolio since the formation of the Trudeau government shift around as well. In fact, she was Minister for Crown Indigenous Relations since 2015. And I do know the whole Indigenous Affairs Minister or Indigenous Affairs related portfolios have all changed. Paddy Hyde, the former health minister, has moved over to Indigenous Services, and Mark Miller has moved to Crown Indigenous Relations. And we talked about the importance of Mary May Simon as the new Governor General of Canada. And don't forget, Sam, this is coming off the back of Trudeau having to apologize to First Nations people after he went on holiday instead of attending the first First Nations reconciliation ceremony that his government set up, which led to accusations that it was kind of a virtual signaling kind of move rather than trying to see actual progress. So a whole new team in charge of Indigenous relations suggests that more work will be done in this area, isn't it?
Indeed. And I think firefighting in that department was also married with the firefighting in the Defence Department, which explained a lot about Anita Anand's promotion to Defence, because obviously, for those who don't know, there was a big scandal going on within the Defence Department over sexual harassment claims within the military, and a new figure was needed to shake up the department and try and investigate these claims. And I think Anita Anand's promotion had a lot to do with that.
I agree. And that is something which we will see very much what she's going to do. That's a big job now. She's moved on from Minister for Public Services Procurement into that portfolio. Just a couple more things to think about, Sam. Is this the cabinet to survive, let's say, 2 or 3 years? Because let's be honest, minority governments, as we said many times on Canada, do not last 4 years. They tend to last between 2 to 3 years. Can we expect another reshuffle before then? Would this government last a full minority term?
I tend to think that this one might last the full minority term, mainly because reshuffles inherently come with a lot of risk, because you are deciding people's political fates, and obviously for every person you promote in a reshuffle, someone has to be demoted as well. And for someone like Justin Trudeau, who is going into quite a treacherous term in terms of his political future, because whether he wants to or not lead the Liberal Party into the next election, I think the Liberal Party will have a lot to say about that now that he's only managed to put them in a minority position 2 times in a row. And I think when you have that kind of leadership risk always on the back burner, the chances of you shaking up the party framework, potentially dividing the party, motivating rivals, I think that's a risk that you're not going to take when you're in a political position like Justin Trudeau. And as I said, I think some of these domestic projects that he's clearly trying to focus on in this reshuffle take time. And if you want to deliver them properly, if you genuinely want to deliver that change in climate policy and housing policy and mental health policy, having some continuity at the top of these portfolios will really help that delivery. So personally, I think this cabinet is probably here to stay.
I actually disagree with you there. I think there are some clues that potentially we're looking maybe middle of in 1.5 years' time as another reshuffle. Because I look at the portfolios given to some of the newcomers. I think particularly they prove themselves, and this is assuming that no ministers have resigned due to scandal, that there could be opportunities for some of the newcomers to gain additional portfolios as well. So for example, Helena Jazzik is only Minister for Southern Ontario Development, which is a small development agency, actually. And I think very much room to grow in terms of assuming additional portfolio responsibilities as well. Possibly, if you look at Mary Ng, she's in charge of export promotion, trade, economic development, and small business. You can definitely give one of those portfolios, possibly even a small business portfolio, off to Helena Jazzik as someone who needs to, as a newcomer to cabinet who needs to have a small portfolio, gain a foothold and grow in it. She could possibly take on one of those portfolios in the future. Hence, that's why I think that potentially one more reshuffle in this government left. Do you agree? Do you possibly buy that?
I completely see your point there. And I think there will be a lot of political maneuvering over the next couple of years within the Liberal Party, and potentially a reshuffle will play a role in that. But I think my scepticism mainly comes from the risk you take when you do that and whether Justin Trudeau is going to be prepared to take that risk.
Yeah, and you know, the last thing we can talk about is this going to, who's next in this to replace Justin Trudeau? Because I'm not sure if you agree with me, Sam, but the number of contenders possibly with this reshuffle to succeed him has possibly increased, hasn't it?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, it's widely regarded that Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, is the front runner to replace Justin Trudeau. And I think this reshuffle certainly suggests that that position hasn't changed, because in a reshuffle where 10 ministers only retained their position, and she was one of them in the key cabinet position, demonstrates to me the power of her as an individual within the Liberal Party and in the eyes of Justin Trudeau. So for me, I think Chrystia Freeland is still the person to beat. But then you have figures like Anita Anand, who has received quite a significant promotion. And if she delivers on this reform within the military and can clearly handle quite a significantly pressing scandal, then I think that's another name we'll be talking about. And I think you have someone here who Justin Trudeau clearly has a lot of confidence in, and the Liberal Party more generally might also take on that confidence. But then there were a couple of people who I think lost out. So Mark Garner was often seen as a potential replacement to Justin Trudeau, but age was always a factor, and now that he's out of cabinet, I'm not sure that he will receive the endorsement of the Liberal Party for the leadership, but could be someone who could potentially rock the boat a bit. If he genuinely still has leadership ambitions, he could be the sort of person to eventually stick the knife into Justin Trudeau if they really want to go down that route. But I still think on the leadership question in the Liberal Party, you have almost what I could describe as the elephant who's not in the room, which is Mark Carney, who is another figure whose name has constantly been brought up as a potential Justin Trudeau replacement, and he's not in the cabinet. He's not even in parliament. So I don't really think you can have a full conversation about the potential future of the leadership of the Liberal Party by just looking at this reshuffle, but I certainly think it offers quite a lot of clues.
Well, on the Mark Garner point, I've been hearing rumours that Justin Trudeau is intending to appoint him as Canada's ambassador to France, which would get rid of the leadership problem that or create problem he had as well. In terms of age, I do agree with your point as well, because another person who is out is Jim Carr, who was the minister without portfolio and special representative for the Prairies. And I do think Manitoba could prove problematic, because Manitoba is now down to one cabinet minister in the Northern Affairs Minister, Dan Fadell, and which is less than New Brunswick, which I think could be problematic as well. And genuinely, you know, the idea of Western alienation, which is why Jim Carr was given a special portfolio, you know, when they had no seats in Alberta, Saskatchewan after the last election, that, and with the oil moves particularly, this could antagonize them once again. And I would like to just bring out a final name as well, as someone who clearly with this reshuffle got one of the biggest promotions, Melanie Joly, as foreign minister to replace Mark Garneau. You know, that was one of the, if not aside from Anita Anand, and I totally think that she's also coming to the leadership question. You know, Melanie Joly was trusted by Justin Trudeau to help run the Quebec campaign for the Liberals and did well. They didn't lose any seats in Quebec. You know, she's bilingual and she has served in economic development portfolios, heritage, which was a bit of a rocky start for her, but economic development, now foreign affairs. You know, these are, she's done economics, she's doing foreign affairs, she's clearly gaining that cabinet experience. So I would think that she's also someone to watch out as well. And finally, I will just leave this point. The Canadian Liberals have alternated between a Francophone and an Anglophone over all its leaders. Justin Trudeau is a Francophone, having hailed from Montreal and represent Papillon. Melanie Joly is a Francophone herself, so that could discount her, but not Chrystia Freeland, who represents the Toronto-based riding.
Do you agree with me that Chrystia Freeland is still the front runner if you look at this cabinet?
Yes, because I think even with our X-Factor candidate, the clear thing is that he's not in parliament. And I just don't think the Liberals will go for that. Because the reality is that creating a by-election, particularly in a minority parliament, is risky. Even though they did gain seats, they are still short. And you never know what will happen. And I just don't think that they will want to risk having a by-election, unnecessary by-election in this term, depending on where the seat is. So I still think that Chrystia Freeland is the front runner. And, you know, the other thing is Justin Trudeau has been keen to promote women. And the Liberals have still not had a female leader. You know, the Conservatives had in Kim Campbell, the New Democrats have, you know, the Bloc has, the Greens has. The Liberals are the odd one now. And I think that, and that ensures that Chrystia Freeland is definitely the front runner.
And I'm sure we'll be talking about that quite extensively over the next 2 years, if indeed Justin Trudeau decides not to take his party into the next election. And for the full list of changes of the Canadian cabinet reshuffle, you can follow us on Twitter at @ballot_talk for all the information and analysis.
Okay, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About, where we'll be moving on to events south of the 44th parallel, and where voters in the traditionally blue state of New Jersey and what we think is a trending blue state of Virginia head to the polls. In New Jersey, incumbent Democratic Governor Phil Murphy is running for re-election, but very much all eyes are on Virginia, where incumbent Democratic Governor Ralph Northam is term limited, and the Democrats have chosen former governor, and in fact, Northam's immediate predecessor, Terry McAuliffe, as their nominee. And he's being challenged by the nominee for the Republicans, Glenn Youngkin. So that, and that will be the focus of the discussion. But we also will be talking about the end about two notable House races in Ohio. The 11th Congressional District, which is based from Cleveland, to replace now Housing Secretary Marcia Fudge, and the 15th Congressional District based in Southern Ohio to replace Republican Steve Strickers, who resigned to become president of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. So Sam, before we move on to Virginia, which is definitely where all eyes will be on Tuesday, why do states such as New Jersey and Virginia hold their gubernatorial elections in off years? And do you think what's the upside and downsides of doing so?
I looked into both of these stories about Virginia and New Jersey, who are both slightly different. Virginia almost seems to be an accident that they hold their election on an off year, whereas New Jersey very much seems to be by design. The Virginia story goes right back to 1851, when their first gubernatorial election was held. And then in 1868, after the American Civil War, they redrafted Virginia's constitution. And because the ratification referendum for the constitution was put off until 1869, they ended up holding the gubernatorial election that year and have held it every 4 years ever since. Whereas on the New Jersey side, it was after World War II in 1947 where the gubernatorial contest was actually moved to the year after presidential elections because they viewed it as too important to be overshadowed by the presidential election. I mean, some people had a theory that Republican Governor Driscoll at the time wanted to distance himself from FDR, who just won his fourth term in office as a Democratic president. But there does seem to be some logic to me for holding the election in an off year if you did want to separate the two contests. And I think this year we'll be seeing whether that actually works, because there still is a lingering feeling of Joe Biden versus the Trump Republicans going on underneath these two contests. And I'm sure we'll be talking today as to whether that will materialize this time around. But I thought both of them were quite interesting stories.
I agree with you. I do think they're very interesting stories. But the one thing I'm always concerned with is that US elections, as we know, until the Trump era, we saw turnout tend to fall off a cliff, isn't it, in these non-presidential elections. So particularly one where you've got midterms next year and voters in Virginia and New Jersey will be going to the polls next year to elect either their senators but definitely their congressmen and women. Why would you on earth would you hold a governor election in between those two events? Because you could still hold it in the midterm next year and still get a reasonable turnout, because until the Trump era, turnout was quite abysmal. So then the whole question of legitimacy comes into play, isn't it?
It does. But I think New Jersey and Virginia have come quite suited to enjoying the limelight they get in the year after the presidential election, because every time they end up being portrayed by the media as the bellwether of party support and presidential approval. So I think it just gets them in the limelight, actually.
Indeed. And I think that's a good point to move on and talk probably about the contest in which you and I will be looking out for, which is the Virginia governor election. And we should note that Virginia is not only electing its governor, it's electing the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and the chamber and its lower house as well. So it's a whole suite of offices up for election. As we mentioned at the top, incumbent Democratic governor Ralph Northam is term limited. And governors in Virginia are limited to only a single term. But you, as Terry McAuliffe, its candidate, you can run again after you've had one term out. The Republicans have chosen Glenn Youngkin in its candidate. But frankly, are you surprised as I am, Sam, that this race is as close as it appears to be at this stage, isn't it? Considering that in the 2020 presidential election, Virginia was nowhere close in terms of its margin for Joe Biden, isn't it?
I am surprised it's close because, as you said, Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in Virginia by 10%. And this election, at least if you take the polls at face value, seems to be that it's going to be within a couple of points either way. But at the moment, I think the RCP polling average has McAuliffe leading on about 1.8% average. However, these elections have a history of being close and have a history of going the way you don't expect. There have, since 1989, there have been 8 New Jersey gubernatorial elections and 8 Virginia gubernatorial elections. 15 of those 16 elections have gone against the incumbent president party, whether that be the party that is traditionally a winner in those states or not. So there has only been one occasion since 1989 where either of those have gone to the incumbent president's party. And interestingly enough, that was in 2013, and it was Terry McAuliffe in Virginia. So I think he'll be hoping he can pull that off again this time. So I think it's important to realise that these elections are usually quite competitive and sometimes surprisingly competitive. Look at Chris Christie in New Jersey, for example, winning as a Republican in a trending Democratic state at that time. And even in the Virginia example, 2013 was the only time since 1973 that a candidate has won who is the same party as the president. So these elections tend to produce quite unusual results because they are in the off year and because they are the first chance for voters to either express their approval of the president's party or alternatively go for a split ticket option where they can have their state run by one party while the country is being run by another.
You say that, but one of the things that we notice in US presidential elections is that voters are very much more partisan and potentially, you know, in the past. If you voted Democrat now, you tend to stick voting Democrat up and down the ticket and across a certain period of time. I get your point potentially of them flip-flopping as well, but in a state that, if we exclude New Jersey for a bit and just focus on Virginia, that is trending very much towards the Democrats, I still find it remarkable that it's this close though, because I get the point there could be some backlash and there could be some reversion back to somewhat of a mean, but 10 points is a huge gap, particularly in such a polarized partisan country, to me suggests that the top of the ticket, Joe Biden, must be dragging the Democrats' approval rating down as well. Do you think that's possibly a reason why?
I think it is possible. And it's worth noting that Joe Biden's personal approval rating is now only at 48% and seems to be declining in recent weeks. And I think that's having an effect on these candidates and particularly on Terry McAuliffe, even though Joe Biden is not running in this cycle, but still has a down ballot impact. And a lot of people are citing things like the failure of the Democrats to pass the infrastructure bill or Build Back Better anytime soon, even though there were talks of that happening this week in advance of COP26. But as you said, split ticketing has gone down. So it does seem unusual. And just to illustrate split ticketing going down, in the year 2000, at the turn of the millennium, there were 30 senators for states that the other party's presidential candidate won. Now there are just 6. That is how low split ticketing has been on the state level in recent years. So it does seem incredibly surprising to me that this race is so close. But with it being a low turnout, low salience election, potentially that has a lot to do with it as well, because we know that the demographics who traditionally voted Republican in these bluer states, the more blue Republicans, tend to turn out more regularly.
Well, I would say the new Democratic coalition, a much more educated, college-educated coalition, could be the saving grace for the Democrats, actually. You know, in the past, these voters who have probably voted Republican, being more college-educated and all, but now have, thanks under the Trump era, as the Republicans have gotten for the lower propensity voting working-class voters, the Democrats have gotten, you know, the more college-educated voters, particularly around Northern Virginia as well. And, you know, to give you an extent of the split voting ticket issue about the decline in that, Biden's approval rating is underwater in New Jersey. But the New Jersey race is expected to go Democrat regardless. So that is the extent to which partisan of a state has completely trumped with whatever has taken place. And I think that is, if it's not Joe Biden, we have to therefore look at Terry McAuliffe, isn't it, as a candidate? Because I suspect, if you agree with me, Sam, that probably a fuller picture is that both are potentially causing this quite alarming tightening in the polls. Because until, I would say, Sam, about a month ago, it looked like quite a reasonably comfortable victory for the Democrats. We didn't expect them to reach potentially the Ralph Northam margin, but certainly, Sam, it was never expected to be this close, isn't it?
No, and I mean, Terry McAuliffe left office in 2017 with a plus 11% approval rating and was widely seen when he entered this race for governor this time around to be quite a popular candidate. Do you think he has become an ineffective candidate throughout this campaign?
I think two things on Terry McAuliffe. One is his campaign tactics, which tried to lean very heavily on the 2017 playbook, which saw Ralph Northam beat the opinion polls and record a better-than-expected victory. And he did that, if you recall, by very much playing the Trump card. I still see Terry McAuliffe trying to do that. But the key difference between 2017 and now is that Trump is not president. You know, there's only so much excitement you can generate out of, yes, Trump is politically involved, but he's not the head of state. So that weapon is no longer there for the Democrats. And crucially as well, that 2017 gubernatorial election came really around the same time Charlottesville happened. And you recall Charlottesville was a horrific event that took place and really, I suspect, shook a lot of college-educated and disgusted a lot of college-educated voters who were anyway more likely to vote in the first place, made them much more enthusiastic. This time round, we have a Democratic president, so Democratic enthusiasm will be reduced. The Republicans sent blood in the water, so their voters will be much more willing to come out. And I do think that this has to be considered as well, because the Virginia Constitution has been designed so that no governor, as I mentioned at the top, should run for re-election, given that you have to step down. Although this is technically allowed, I wonder how many Virginians feel like this is kind of a violation of what the state constitution intended. Because the state constitution only intended the governor to serve one term. And essentially, this will be Terry McAuliffe's second term. Although legally, he's still able to. I wonder how much voters are kind of disgusted by going against the spirit of the constitution. And therefore, these college-educated voters might not necessarily turn out as into the levels we could expect. Do you buy that theory, Sam?
I do, and I think that is one of the more logistical reasons why I think voters might be turning against Terry McAuliffe. I mean, you talk about the different dynamics to 2017. I think it applies to New Jersey just as much as it applies to Virginia. So in Virginia's case, we have Glenn Youngkin, who has received Trump's endorsement but refused to campaign with Trump and Steve Bannon when they came to Virginia to launch their Take Back Virginia rally. And then in New Jersey, you have the Republican candidate Jack Chattarelli, who not only defeated two very Trumpian candidates in the primary in June for the Republican nomination, he has not received an endorsement for President Trump and obviously has not campaigned with him either. So do you think Democrats are disappointed that the Trump factor doesn't really seem to be something that sticks in this election? Because you can argue as much as you want that the Republican Party is still run by Donald Trump, but if you're facing two candidates who are almost tacitly rejecting Donald Trump's participation in the Republican Party, do you think that makes it a more difficult argument to take part in?
Yeah, I think that does help. And let's be honest, he's also been quite quiet over the last month. And I do wonder, you know, how much the press keeps reporting. I mean, you and I are both quite active on Twitter and we look at his statements that he's released, you know, as the office of the 45th president of the United States. But I wonder how much the average voter actually listens to it. And so therefore, if you're not paying attention to that, you might think Trump has sort of disappeared from view apart from the odd rally here and then and to air his frustration and grievances. And, you know, the reality is that the news cycle in America has been very much dominated by what the Biden administration has failed to do. not only on the infrastructure bill, which has received a lot of airtime this week, but also the other domestic priorities. We saw the Liberals fighting the more moderate elements as well. You know, Afghanistan, you know, as could also still have the lingering effects of this, the cost of living crisis. You know, it's swirling into quite a perfect storm, isn't it? That has sort of shifted the focus away from Donald Trump, who has, I suspect, been also quite tacitly clever, because he knows that given the profile of this state, if he goes to Virginia or goes to New Jersey, it will have backfired completely, won't it, Sam? Even in some areas of Virginia, like Southwest Virginia, he probably would have juiced turnout there, but it probably would have the opposite effect in more populous areas of Northern Virginia and around Richmond. The other thing I would consider as well is the entire ticket. So the entire the Democrats ticket, Terry McAuliffe as governor, Mark Herring running for re-election as attorney general, and Hala Hadeo as lieutenant governor, are all hailing from Northern Virginia. Now that is a problem for a state which is huge, and where Ralph Northam last time around did very well in Norfolk Beach, in the area in the south of the state as well, close to the North Carolinian border. I do think regional dynamics at play here, and the Republican ticket with Glenn Youngkin, based born in Richmond, which is the state capital and not from Northern Virginia, is also very important as well. So I think these nuances should also be understood in its full context. Don't you think so, Sam?
I do. But there's something else to mention about the Virginian ticket, which we haven't really talked about yet, but I think is going to have some impact on this election, which is that the Virginian state government was riddled in scandal throughout this last term. You had Ralph Northam and the Attorney General, Mark Herring, who is still on the ballot, both be found to have appeared in blackface. And then you had the Lieutenant Governor accused of a rape and sexual harassment case. So you had all three of the top Democratic officials in the government accused of quite significant scandal. And one of the only reasons they didn't seem to take any action on that was because if all three of them had left office, it would be the Republican Speaker of the lower chamber who would be taking over as the governor of Virginia. So even though you have Terry McAuliffe, a new face at the top of this ticket, you still have that lingering legacy of this scandal-riddled period, not least Mark Herring still being on the ticket, which I wonder if that plays a role as well, because Virginians feel like there should have been some accountability for these scandals and nobody ended up resigning over them.
And finally, Sam, before we move on to talk about New Jersey and Ohio in a minute, we also should look at the House of Delegates, the lower house as such, where all the seats in the 100-seat chambers up for re-election. The Democrats currently have a 5-vote cushion in that. Do you think that there's any risk of being lost to Republicans? Because if it does, we have divided government in Virginia, regardless of who the governor election wins, because the Senate is currently held in Democratic hands, isn't it? So do you think that there's any threat to that, the Democrats' hold on the chamber?
I think there is a potential threat, and I think the threat comes from the fact that the race at the top of the ticket is incredibly close. And Glenn Youngkin's campaign has all been orientated around trying to bring back demographics that had traditionally voted Republican in Virginia, not least a growing Latino population and also some northern Virginians who turned away from the party because of Donald Trump. But there is a key caveat here, which is that there has been a delayed redistricting data issue in Virginia, which may mean that we'll be getting a new map in Virginia that they will have to rerun these elections on next year. So I would hold your breath on the lower house, because whatever the results are next week, it might be that next year they get changed anyway.
Indeed. And, you know, when we come to midterms, we've got another round of elections to look forward to. It's probably one of the few people to be very excited about that. Let's move on to New Jersey, and which has very much flown under the radar, Sam, I'm sure you agree. And as we briefly mentioned, the incumbent Democratic governor, Phil Murphy, is eligible and running for re-election and facing Jack Citarati, who is the Republican's candidate. Do you expect the Democrats to lose this? This is a starting question. And if so, this would be a bigger surprising loss, isn't it, compared to Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, I would be incredibly surprised if the Democrats lost this election, and I think it would be incredibly concerning for the Democrats if they lost this one, because New Jersey is even more solidly Democrat than Virginia is traditionally in recent presidential elections. And really, this New Jersey election has flown so far under the radar because of the apparent strength of Phil Murphy as the governor candidate there, that I think if this were to go to the Republicans, it would be an absolute failure of data collection and campaign focus if that is what was to transpire. I think it will probably be closer than the presidential election was in New Jersey, but if Phil Murphy goes on to lose this, I think it would be an incredible disappointment for the Democratic Party.
And to be honest, I suspect a lot of Democrats get deja vu, because if you remember in 2009, they lost both the Virginia governor election and the New Jersey governor election. The Virginia governor election was not even close, to be honest. Bob McConnell, who was the then governor, romped to victory at that time around. And it proved an ominous sign for the Democrats heading into the 2010 cycle, where they lost control of the House. This time around, the margin in the U.S. House of Representatives, they have a lot less margin to play with. And so therefore, if the New Jersey governor election is lost, I think that would shock a lot of people, not going to lie, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to note, though, is that no Democratic governor in New Jersey has won a second term since 1977 under Governor Brendan Byrne. So if Phil Murphy were to pull this off, which it does seem likely that he will, it will be a historical upset in terms of the trends of Democratic governors in this state. But because of the context of just how Democratic New Jersey seems to have become, and just how popular Phil Murphy has been as a governor in recent years, I think it would be still a huge surprise, even if it meets historical standards, for Phil Murphy to lose.
And finally, before we talk about our predictions for what the race could look like, the House races in Ohio, we briefly mentioned, the 11th congressional district are based on Cleveland, and in Southern Ohio, 15th congressional district, my apologies, to replace Steve Stricker. I think you agree, Sam, that we're probably expecting both parties to hold it, right? The Democrats hold the 11th and the Republicans hold the 15th. They're both pretty safe seats, isn't it?
Definitely. Again, I think these should be pretty routine defenses for the parties. And if either of them were to go the other way, I would be immensely surprised. I think the one House-related election that's taking place next Tuesday that might be interesting is actually a Democratic primary for Florida 20th, because there are quite a number of candidates running to replace Alcee Hastings as the member for Florida 20th. And although they'll be facing re-election immediately next year, I think the state of that primary might say a lot about, one, the Democratic Party and the strength of progressives, but also, two, the kind of focus they're going to put on the state of Florida, which is becoming a really interesting state for the Democrats because they're failing to pull through on the presidential level. But they have a really key Senate race there next year when Val Demings is going up against Marco Rubio. So I think this primary might say a lot about how the Democrats want to position themselves in Florida.
Indeed. And I think that's also a very good point, actually, because I kind of feel like the Democrats thought that, you know, with changing demographics, Florida would be slowly moving their column. But this is, we've had numerous election cycles, 2016, 2018, 2020, where the Democrats fell short in Florida. So the signs do not look good, particularly as the president suffering faltering approval ratings as well. So, Sam, I presume we're not going to be much surprised where we expect New Jersey to remain Democratic governor whole. Ohio, we expect both House races to remain the same. But I'm going to put you on the spot in Virginia, because I'm curious, do you think Terry McAuliffe will pull this off? Or are we going to expect a Governor Glenn Youngkin?
I think that Terry McAuliffe will pull this off. And I'm going to be quite controversial here in saying that I think he'll pull it off with a bigger margin than polls were expecting. The early vote numbers, which are impossible to read into, as we well know, look quite promising for the Democrats in terms of tracking turnout for previous Virginia governor elections, and also about halfway towards, I think, the last time I checked, the presidential level. So I don't think we're going to get near the 10% that Biden won over Trump, but it wouldn't surprise me if if Terry McAuliffe wins this by 4 or 5, 6% potentially.
Oh, interesting. I actually think that there is still a possibility of an upset, to be honest, because I think you can't escape the fact that the Republicans are very much more greater voter enthusiasm. The Democrats are frankly facing a lot of trouble. They haven't passed anything of significant legislating of note. And I do think the polls should be about correct, about a 1 to 2 point margin potentially. Either way is how I'm going to say it. But the problem for the Democrats is this. If I look at the last two governor elections, so that's the 2013-2017 one, the polls have underestimated one candidate, and it's usually the opposing party candidate to the president. So in 2013, Terry McAuliffe was expected to win, if I look at the polls, by quite comfortable margins, actually. Some were predicting between 7 to 10 points, and it ended up being a nearly 2-point victory for Terry McAuliffe in 2013. In 2017, it was expected to be a 2 to 3-point race, and Ralph Northam ended up winning by 8. So it clearly seems that if we look at history, that the downsides are mainly on the Democratic front. And that, to me, with all the science, does give me that if Glenn Youngkin wins next Tuesday, I would certainly not be surprised, I have to be honest.
Well, it's all to play for. It makes it more interesting when we have different opinions on what's going to happen. So let's see.
Indeed. And we're going to have to find out next week, because that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Join us again next week when we'll be reviewing the recent Japanese and US elections. And as always, we will continue to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_talk. And do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.